Okay, thank you all for coming this evening. The late, great Southern novelist Walker Percy once wrote an essay about what it meant to be a writer. He likened writers to the canary in the coal mine. For those of you unfamiliar with early coal mining practice, the miners would bring a caged canary with them deep into the mine. Canaries were more fragile, more sensitive to the foul gases than were the human beings. If the canary fell over dead, the miners knew there was a problem. Then it was time to come up for air. Canaries were their early warning system, and that's the crucial role Walker Percy believed writers were destined to play in society. Rue Freeman is one very special canary. She writes with a strong sense of purpose, sounding alarms to save the unfortunate from the holes society has put them in. Both of her novels, On Sal Mal Lane and A Disobedient Girl, portray life in a period of political instability in Sri Lanka, which is where she's from. Both novels received significant awards and worldwide literary critical acclaim. Reviews include words like mesmerizing, extraordinary, stunning, beautiful, powerful, vivid, captivating. She's been praised for being an advocate for women and workers, and for her ability to, quote, engage with caste, fatalism, the oppression of women, and the tragedy of making the wrong decisions. I should also mention that she isn't limited to Sri Lankan issues. She's also edited Extraordinary Rendition, which is a collection of essays by 65 prominent writers, including the likes of George Saunders and Alice Walker, dealing with the plight of the Palestinians. The fact that her work has been translated into Italian, French, Turkish, Dutch, and Chinese testifies to the international relevance of her writing. But she doesn't just talk the talk. She holds a graduate degree in labor studies, researching female migrant labor in Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia. She has worked at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., in the South Asia office of the AFL-CIO, and with the American Friends Service Committee in their humanitarian and disaster relief programs. In short, she's fighting the good fight. And I think winning far more than most of us. And we are honored to have her here with us this evening. Please welcome Rue Freeman.
I had promised to do a striptease, but we started late, so there's no time for that. I'm actually going to read from the new novel, which is not set in Sri Lanka. Thank you for that wonderful introduction, Clint. I met Clint last year, and it was such a pleasure to come across someone like him whose work I didn't know at the time, and I got to know. But it's not just the work, it's the human being who's producing it and what they are like as people and fellow travelers on the same journey. And to me, Clint was such a person, and it's too bad that time together was cut short a little bit, so I'm very glad to have some time here with you. So the new novel is set in two unnamed places, kind of recognizable. But I'm still making a decision about this. So this is actually brand new stuff, meaning it's not out there yet, but it will be. And it might change from what I'm going to read to you. So if it changes and it's terrible in the new iteration, you can just say, she read it before, it was really good then. Or vice versa. She read it before, it was terrible, but I'm so glad she did some work on that. So you don't really need to know much about what I'm reading. One of the main characters is Omar, and I'm going to read about him. The story moves between an unnamed island in the Pacific and a place that is recognizable in the Middle East as Afghanistan. Change. A new sense of threat weighed on the town. The soldiers occupying his fields acted as though they were in charge of something, but their attitude of tense foreboding gave them away. They did not know him, but he owned them too, now. He was the Sadozai heir he had been groomed to be since he was 5 years old. He needed no training or trial. Marine Corps Lance Corporal Felix Navarro, Company F 2nd Battalion, 9th Marine Regiment Combat Team 5. Omar said these words to the soldier nearest to him, and it makes the man look around for help. "Yes, sir," he says, tentative. Born in Paris, Texas, high school graduate, married 3 years, one daughter, aged 2, a son on the way. Parents not happy with your marriage. "Doug," he calls to a man not far away, and he turns his face slightly toward his friend, but he keeps his eyes on Omar, his weapon ready. Marine Corps Private First Class Douglas Frisk, born in Canaraville, Utah, not married. Girlfriend number 1 is Cynthia Black. Girlfriend number 2 is Mona Silva. He puts the gun up, but there is a call to desist which comes from a man striding over to them. The soldier lowers the gun. Marine Corps Staff Sergeant Major Preston Adams, Omar says to Sergeant Navarro, holding his gaze. He speaks softly so that only Navarro can hear. He will not outlive this war. He nods to the soldier and walks towards the superior officer to discuss the delivery of supplies. He doesn't have to look back to know that they are clumping together behind him, discussing the things they don't understand. They will come to the wrong conclusion. He does not own this land. He is owned by its history. The soldiers are permitted to stay, but they are a mere decoration. They prevent nothing, they precipitate nothing other than curiosity. His men work the fields as they have always done. It is tapped and collected and prepared for sale as before. The only difference is that mostly white men with ribbons and medals on their uniforms have become dealers who supply the streets of their cities with the product against which their government has declared war. This irony escapes them as much else does. Neither he nor his people are surprised, and he does not trouble himself with these petty distinctions. He has no attachment to the quality of his consumer when it comes to this now rudimentary form of self-medication. There were many ways to wage a war. Still, this was what was bequeathed to him, what he will pass on, and so he tends to it. He could have grown other things, beets, maize, sunflowers, tomato, apricot, grape, even cotton, but this is what his uncle, and now he, had chosen to do. They had both spent time in those universities abroad with their gray and maroon mascots, where most of what was studied was inconsequential for those exalted few whose company both of them had kept. His uncle, and now he, would do as their American peers did. Those men had gone on to own the things that mattered in that country, chief among which was money, and therefore the country itself. And he and his uncle had kept hold of what mattered in theirs, tradition. He would do as his uncle had done, protecting what they had, a hierarchy of power that could maintain order by investing what he earned in places of education, in enterprises that produced consumer products, cottonseed oil, soap, in infrastructure. What had been passed down to him, he would keep safe no matter that his own business brought him a kind of wealth that surpassed his uncle's. He had acquired a knack for safety from Aziz. There was nothing here that would survive without the protection of the right people, and the way to ensure safety was to become that person whose task it was to protect, whose goodwill was always sought, whose vengeance was not to be provoked. Money was useful, but it could only reward and not secure loyalty. He conducted his business as his uncle did. With Babi at his side, he handpicked the men he brought to the fields and instructed them on the ways in which the business was run, which was different from those of others they may have worked at before. He was loyal to his workers and expected the same in return. He took care not only of them but of their families, against threats from their own people as well as the soldiers. Whatever loss was suffered, he would compensate. Beyond that, he permitted what was necessary, while containing what was not. He allowed the soldiers the access to the dams and ditches that lined the fields, slow bodies of water that carried in brown earthen troughs to the fields themselves, and to the men who worked them. They were permitted to speak to any one of them so long as the men were not actively engaged in their tasks, which were always time-sensitive and reliant on the weather, particularly the heat of day and the chill of the evenings. He allowed them safe passage between these areas and the bases to which they fled at night, refugers surrounded by Hasco Bastion wire baskets filled with the toasted caramel-colored soil from his own country that they believed would keep them from harm. The soldiers, for their part, put on their protective clothing and topped their barricades with rolls of barbed wire that were almost as tall as themselves with zeal, and never stopped to consider that the reason why so much ease was given to them in constructing these places was because their superiors wanted them to forget that it was very probable that their camps would be breached and that they would die. They lay exhausted and terrified on hard wooden platforms that could double as stretchers within the gravid interiors, and Omar wondered if they ever looked up at the desert skies, sequined like a dancer's veil at night with stars, if they ever said the word beautiful to themselves. Omar considers the many absurdities of the situation in which they all found themselves, that there were many such bases in the province now, places the American soldiers called green, though they were built in desert dust. How the soldiers went into the villages, bringing women with them, seeking to break loyalties, unable to comprehend the tribal nature of their civitas, which the Americans took to mean factions. Their conviction that what stood between them and victory was the right bit of information about an individual, a single person who might help them destroy the rest. How they could not understand that there was never one person among his people, that every word uttered was tethered to the village by many threads. How they thought that the people here were bound together like the loose knots of fishing nets, when in fact they were linked and inseparable in the fashion of mail. How though Americans relied on what they considered to be solid, verifiable institutions and accused the traditions of his people as being ad hoc and unstable, ephemerality belonged to the Americans, not to them. His people could point to the break in their chains of communication when it came to money, the hawaldar who betrays a trust the associate at each end. Their accounts were always settled, while American newspapers spoke regularly of the collapse of their banks. How the Americans asked for information and were given stories, and how it did not matter what was told to them, what he read of what they found in his town, his uncles, was always far from what was true. How they picked leaders for the province from among people who had spent their years in other places and brought in a vanguard who spoke the dialect of northerners for whom nobody here had any regard. How in all those ways they failed themselves. What was clear to him was this: their interest was not in the people, it was in their product. He visited the tents of their officers and secured the release of prisoners they took from among the brothers and fathers working for him, the ones they removed shackled, their eyes bound in the stretchy bandages used for injuries, and handcuffed and held before them like shields, though it was their victim who was vulnerable and should be afraid. Inside, their compounds were filled with men in uniforms and tanks the color of the sands of Afghanistan, enormous wheeled carriages whose unflinching lines reminded him of things that could not last, nothing that presumed such solidity could. He talked to released men as he walked away with them and did it in such a way that even they could pretend that there was no injustice around them, no invasion, no occupation, no plunder. Passing the fields on his way back and forth these last weeks, he has watched the Americans frolic in the irrigation ditches of his fields, their muscled and tattooed bodies doused in the water he had once played in with his brothers. Sometimes, if he doesn't look at them directly, he can turn the sounds of their play into those made by Asa and Fadi and Safi. The stirred water sloshes the same way against their bodies, and the earth slips into the water under their scrambling feet as it did when he and his brothers hurried to get out. But when he turns his head, he sees them clearly, and they are not his brothers. He has observed the soldiers giving sweets to the children, particularly the girls who stand and smile back at them, flowers themselves amidst the fields of flowers. He watches as they take pictures of the children of themselves with their faces buried in blooms, their arms and bodies strapped with tan clothing, black weapons. He looks at these things and he wishes that all those children could be as hidden as his own are now, far from these soldiers who know nothing about them and would forget them as easily as they could kill them. And then, every now and again, some face touches him. He sees in the cast of an eye or the suddenness of a smile some feature that reminds him of the children who are now his. It startles him into remembering that these soldiers are as one or more of his children might have become had they not been chosen to live with him. But the moments that are more difficult for him are when he is reminded just as swiftly and without warning that these soldiers were once children like the ones on his island, that some twist of fortune had brought them here to die, that it was not their own doing, and most of all, that someone waited for them to come home. He turns away then and returns to the recitation of their titles, to the tasks they have been assigned and that they will complete. It was in the grip of such titles and under such assignations that men just like these murdered his family. Those men had given no thought to who might have loved the family they destroyed, who might have waited for them. He would not die for these fields as his uncle did, but he shrinks from nothing, he flinches at nothing. These soldiers, what do they know of strength, of belonging, of fear, of the willingness to die? It is not valiant to throw a life away on the whim of another man. He knows what courage is. It is to risk everything and be willing to go down with the loss. Burial. Bobby has placed a paper before him. On it are the list of the compounds of families he knows well, but these lists identify those places as being filled with ammunition or ill-willed people, created out of nothing because nobody wanted to believe that any of the people on the ground were innocent. If they died, they deserved it. If they did not deserve it, then the newspapers refused to mention their names or attach that term, innocent, to their stories. Either way, the vaporized will be accorded no honor by the nameless people who spill disaster from the skies as though they were merely urinating in a public toilet, not bothering to flush, but staying long enough to wash their own hands. News from around the country also added to a second list. Mistakes happen, the papers say, after. 56 elders dead. There had been a wedding, they say, after the fact. 40 of his people dead in Dehrawaud. It was ill-advised, they say, to have killed so many people from the same town in Oruzgan. Also ill-advised, the 22 lying dead in Dahbela, in Garalok 16, in Bahkel 10. Why did they go to the middle of a desert to have a wedding celebration, they ask? They did not ask why anybody might go to Sonora, Texas to have a wedding, nor did anybody bomb the weddings that took place there. They say they are protecting, clearing, and rebuilding, but 18 people are dead at a wedding in Sarj. Always the weddings, for perhaps his people are not permitted to gather in celebration or in grief. Al-Qasail, Najiban, four girls, not yet 6 years old, four boys, not yet 12, draped like foraged meat behind a butcher's shop by a mangy stray dog, shot in their mouths. What are you going to do now? He doesn't know to what Bobby refers. These lists of dead, the particular assault that had been tended to, those bodies and those funerals, the death of his uncle, what? There were too many things he had to do. He answered the most immediate, I will go home. Should I stay here? No, you will return to Fars with Nadia. You should not go alone to Lashkargah. Bobby is right. He should not go alone to his uncle's village, reappear as the one whom they failed to kill. But a consecration awaits him there, and he must perform it before the month is done to say the prayer for the absentee over what remains. His uncle had been turned into ash, and there was no burial possible, and yet he cannot fail him. They travel in moonlight, and he can see, even in that dimness, that the newly hired men have continued to work on his uncle's fields, his fields. For miles around, there are blooms, nearly 120,000 plants per hectare, their uniformity giving them away as a successful crop, a well-tended and, more importantly, well-protected one. They are the bedrock of his uncle's riches, his inheritance, but his own wealth now comes from the work of his imagination and the skill of his learning. In the tomb-like secrecy of the caverns underneath the house in Lashkargah, he stands silent with Babi. This was where they had learned the precise calculation of poison and antitoxin. In the room now, there are only the things that his uncle deemed to be treasures. along the near wall, the first editions of books that he prized, along the back, the silk tapestries that he purchased, one a year from the silk merchant. Along the wall to their left, his boxes of carved ceremonial knives, most of them silver, a few of them solid gold, bejeweled and resting in their velvet beds, their blades sharp. He would take the books with him when he left, and they would sit on the new shelves that Nadia will have made for the upstairs bedrooms. When he wakes up each day, he will see these first, his uncle's choices, and according to his preferences, like his flowers, so also his books, preserved for him and those who would come after in the first iteration of themselves. His house would be a museum for the silks and the knives. On some future date, he would arrange them on the walls of his dining room, the central areas where he entertains his guests. They would look up at those walls lined with weaponry and be anxious to begin their meals. They would look up at them when they have finished, when their tongues are just becoming aware of the sensation of ice and sweet, and they would imagine that the knives have floated down off their individual leather mounts, that they would imagine them turning into their composite parts, steel, silver, gold, rubies, sapphires, emeralds, diamonds, all of them blending into rivers of color that wrap them like silk shawls, tightening around their bodies and releasing them into a heaven of their choice. His uncle cannot be buried, and yet he must be. Omar combs through the cinders on hands and knees and does not let Bubby help him. Under the smaller piles of ash that have retained the shape of a former life, the odd and temporary calc of what once was, the geometry of a book, the yell of a sofa, he finds the things that fire could not overcome. Next to the sofa, seven of a collection of nine brass elephants in different sizes, their trunks unlooped from the tail of another, except for two. They were once used to weight opium for sale. They are tarnished but intact, and he beckons to Bubby to add them to the things they will take away. They are a reminder of what his uncle valued. Aziz Sadozai's signet ring, he finds under the ash inside what was the living room. He wipes it clean. His initials are hard to make out in their ancient Abjadi script. The Hams accented black backward L and the simple forward strike of his first and second initials A and K, forming a kind of guard to the comma curve and line of the S of his family name, which is raised higher than both the other letters. He slips it on the little finger of his right hand, the opposite hand of the one he had used. He does this without thinking, but then he is reminded of all the times he had kissed this ring on his uncle's hand. And he remains for a long time on his knees, his head bowed. This, too, is awake. In the end, what he finds of their bodies is what has remained after the carrion birds have picked at them. A single wrist, a piece of rib that looks like a wind instrument, and a bit of skull. He takes off the purple silk scarf he has been wearing and lays it on the ground. He places each piece on it. If they were under glass in some laboratory or museum, there would be labels in neat typescript. One label might say that the specimen is of the pisiform bone of a carpal belonging to a man, another that the sphenoid bone of the skull belonged to a woman between the age of 50 and 60. Children would rush by without comprehension, but adults would pause, thinking about their own mortality, about each other. He looks at the bones, what is left, only this, in the end, only this. He sees again the 20 marked graves in Marja. He imagines his family turning from the doings of their lives, relinquishing their hold on their thoughts and their emotions, what love they felt for those deserving of their love. He sees his mother leaving the myths behind which she lived, a life of loyalty. He sees Bano fading out of his reach. He sees them leaving their untenanted bodies. He sees their bodies fall to further weightlessness. Someday, 50 years from now, what is left in their graves will be bones like these. Someday, these bones before him, too, to dust.
Hello, everyone. My name is Christina Stanciu, and I'm an assistant professor of English here at VCU. It's an honor to introduce one of my personal sheroes tonight. Her name is Lian Hao, and she is a poet, a fiction writer, a filmmaker, a playwright, a scholar, a friend. Before earning her MFA from Vermont College, Lian was a journalist for 12 years, and then taught at a number of prestigious universities, which include the University of Minnesota and the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. A citizen of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma, Leanne is now the Eidson Distinguished Professor in American Literature at the University of Georgia. I met Leanne over 10 years ago when I was a graduate student at the University of Illinois, where she was teaching in the English and American Indian Studies programs. And I think that besides being one of the most prolific contemporary writers and artists I know, Leanne is also one of the most generous mentors in the field to both native and non-native writers and scholars. And as you'll soon discover, a writer with a deep sense of humanity and a sharp sense of humor. At the heart of her scholarly and literary work is the representation of Native and Indigenous history. Her poetry collection, Evidence of Red, published in 2005, won the Oklahoma Book Award, and her first novel, Shell Shaker, won the Before Columbus Foundation's American Book Award. Her most recent novel is Miko King's, An Indian Baseball Story, and her most recent book, Chalk Talking on Other Realities, from which you'll read tonight, won the Modern Language Association inaugural prize for studies in Native American literatures, cultures, and languages in 2014. Now, when Leanne is not writing poetry, fiction, or creative nonfiction, she writes about film, or hosts and produces documentaries. She was the narrator and host of the 2006 PBS documentary Indian Country Diaries, Spiral of Fire. And with Ojibwe director Jim Fortier, Leanne wrote and co-produced a superb documentary titled Playing Pastime, American Indian Fast Pitch Softball and Survival, which is about Southeastern Native tribes who have been playing baseball and fast pitch softball since the 1880s, right, in Oklahoma. And one of my favorite Leanne moments was her appearance on The Daily Show. I bet you did not know this, on Comedy Central years ago, maybe 2007, where she twisted Asif Manvi's hand literally and educated the nation on the damage Indian mascots do on college campuses and beyond. And I think this is a very timely issue, especially given the Washington football team. And in 2013, Leanne also edited a collection of essays on Native film I was very honored to contribute to, called Seeing Red, Pixel Skins, American Indians, and Film. Leanne is the recipient of many awards, and I won't get to all of them, but they include a U.S. Ford Foundation Fellowship, a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Native Writers Circle of the Americas, and a Fulbright Distinguished Scholar Award to the University of Jordan in Amman, Jordan. In 2006, she was the John and Renee Grisham Writer-in-Residence at the University of Mississippi, and she held many other residencies and read in many countries, including my own, Romania, and also in Japan, and she'll read about that tonight. And in 2012, she was the recipient of the prestigious United States Artist Fellow Award. In 2015, she received the Distinguished Achievement Award from the Western Literature Association, the WLA. Right now, Leanne is at work on several projects, and at dinner you mentioned that your next book of poems, Savage Conversations, is done and forthcoming, and this book will blow your mind, so stay tuned. It's about Mary Todd Lincoln and, quote-unquote, a savage Indian, she said, tortured her at night in an insane asylum in Batavia, Illinois, in the summer of 1875. And with Jim Fortier, she's working on a new and exciting documentary. It's called Searching for Sequoia. Searching for Sequoia is a documentary about the famous creator of the Cherokee syllabary in the early 19th century. Of this book she's going to read from tonight, Chalk Talking on Other Realities, poet Dean Rader said the following, quote, "This extraordinary collection does for Choctaw storytelling what the Hunger Games does for archery. It makes something seemingly traditional and archaic feel edgy, new, and necessary." end quote. We are truly fortunate to welcome Leanne to VCU, so please help me in giving her a warm round of applause.
Thank you so much for having me at VCU. Virginia has been very important to me over the years. Miko Kings was written about a Choctaw who comes out to Hampton University, and during that period of time when it was an experiment between blacks and Indians, so I felt like he belonged. He had come here. He hadn't. Choctaws were never here. But nevertheless, I wrote about that experience of Hampton. And this, not this week, but the next week, I think I'm going back to Hampton to do a project there again. So it's been really wonderful. The play that we're doing that will premiere in August, called Sideshow Freaks and Circus Engines, two of the characters, one is Walter Plecker. How many in the room know who Walter Plecker was, that terrible man who went about the business of erasing Indian identity, and he did it for the state of Virginia. And he happily, I always thought he whistled while he changed their identities from American Indians to African Americans. And so he's in this new play, and he's a parasitic twin of Prescott Bush. Does everybody know who Prescott Bush is? Well, he was bad too. Prescott Bush, the grandfather of Herbert Walker Bush, went down and dug up the remains of Geronimo, took his head back to Yale, and that's part of the skull and bones history at Yale. So they're parasitic twins, and they do a mambo dance in this new play called Sideshow Freaks and Circus Engines. So I'm just giving myself a plug, I guess, or at least talking about why Virginia has always loomed large in one way or another in our work, or my work, and then the work that Monique Mojica and I are doing in August. So I want to thank the people whose land this is, and I certainly want to thank Clint, who I met when I was enormously fortunate enough to get to go and teach at Vermont College in Vermont, where I'm also an alum, so it was a real honor. And then we found out we had friends in common. It's a pleasure also to read with Rue Freeman, who I'm just getting to know, and it was a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful piece of fiction. So I'm honored to be here. Okay, I am going to read from Chalk Talking, which is a memoir. It's creative nonfiction, and it's about my life in travels. And this is called I Fuck Up in Japan. And I was telling everybody at dinner, I really did, every day, constantly, for almost a month, wherever I went. So this is a very long story. It's about 29,000 words. So I'm going to read from two pieces. And like, how many of you are in the MFA program, or you're writers here? Well, you know when you are writing that you think you're writing about one thing and it turns out you're writing about something you hadn't thought of. So I was going to tell this story of the many episodes that I was telling y'all at dinner about all the horrible things that happened that I made all these faux pas. So I was writing and it was really funny, and then it turned very serious, and I'm going to read from that serious section, which really is about my uncles in World War II. So, I fuck up in Japan. The first time I experienced a heated toilet seat was in Okayama City, Japan, February 1993. Some cross-cultural experiences do not easily translate into words. Using a heated toilet seat may be one of them. It was my first trip to the Far East. Before I completed the three-week tour, given lectures to Japanese groups and visiting with local dignitaries in towns and cities, I would have diverse experiences with all manner of toilets and washing apparatus associated with the ofuro, the Japanese bath. I'd been invited to Japan as an American Indian representative to speak at the International Forum on Anti-Discrimination and Human Rights during the 1993 UN International Year of the World's Indigenous Peoples. a mouthful, but it was serious business. The plan was for me to do homestays with local host families throughout Japan and learn about their culture. Ditto for the Japanese. They would learn about me. My tribe was once bullish on homestays. In the 18th century, Choctaws were awash in foreigners. The French, the Alsatians, the Germans, the Swiss, the Irish, the Scots, the occasional Spaniard, a menacing Englishman roaming here and there, all doing immersive family experiments in our homelands. Historic homestays were intended as a kind of tourism, allowing for the sharing of cultures, lifeways, and experiences between different peoples from different lands. I know what you're thinking. It didn't work out for Choctaws or any other American Indian tribe, but since this was the end of the 20th century, I hoped for a better outcome. I prepared myself for investigating the cultural spine of Japan with exploratory questions such as, how do you live? Where is your work? Where's the bathroom? In return, I would reveal what I know of my own cultural anatomy. I am Choctaw, an American Indian from the United States. Yes, perhaps I do carry the genes of other hereditary ancestors. Our ancient mothers took homestays very seriously. I had a month to prepare for my trip to Japan, but wasted a fair amount of time writing chapter titles for a travel book I wanted to write. Quote, my travels in the land of the rising sun, end quote. Quote, an American Indian amongst the samurai, end quote. Sushi or whale blubber, why I chose whale. The last chapter was bound to get attention, I thought, because of the environmentalist, and everybody knows controversy sells. All of this was absolute lunacy. I should have spent my time learning Japanese. I didn't know a single word when I agreed to do the lectures. Of course, I carried a journal with me that had a few words spelled out phonetically. Ohio gozaimasu, good morning. Konnichiwa, good day. Konbanwa, good evening. Sama, gives praise to the one who makes the meal. Idakimasu, I humbly receive. Note that these words are responses to polite conversational banter. I'd also foolishly written out a few sentences that I could read aloud if I was asked about my family. But rare was the opportunity, however, when I could bow properly, hold my journal in one hand, and read the correct words at just the right time. I'd been taught how to bow like a woman by a male Japanese professor at the University of Iowa, where I'd been working as a staff person in international education. I practiced several times in front of the mirror and thought I was prepared for genteel interactions. So far, so good. During the first week in Japan, I stayed in hotels and was hosted by Professor Mitsuhito Kanihara of Hosei University in Tokyo. He spoke English in a soft voice that made me wonder if all Japanese men converse with such gentle countenance. After 8 days, he took me to stay with my first host family in Okinawa City, where the Human Rights Forum was to be held. My Japanese toilet event. A cold spell swept across the entire country the night of my first homestay. Temps plummeted below freezing. Most Japanese homes didn't have a central heating or air conditioning. In a normal February, a vent-free space heater that rolled from room to room would be adequate to heat an average home, but this wasn't an average February. At dusk, heavy, wet snow fell and continued throughout the night. My host family and I communicated through body language and hand gestures. A smile was happiness. Hands on the heart expressed gratitude. I was assured in an official letter from the BRCA Liberation League given to me by my host that a translator was on his way. He would accompany me the rest of my three-week journey throughout Japan and translate my lectures. In the meantime, I was on my own. Went to bed early, and my host shut off the space heater to conserve energy. By midnight, I had to go to the bathroom. The marble-tiled room was lovely, yet bitter as a tomb. I began peeling off the seven layers of clothing I'd worn to bed, including a red pair of Lands' End long johns. I noted the furry material covering the toilet seat while stripping off my clothes, but ignored it. Naked, I sat down, jumped up, and then panicked. Wires inside fur. I'm going to be electrocuted. I flashed on an image of Elvis Presley sitting on the commode just before his ginormous, bloated body dolloped onto the floor. Oh, God, I can't end up like that. The room was so frigid I could see my breath. I didn't know what to do. I'd never felt a woolly toilet seat cover before, let alone a woolly heating pad. My mind was a feverish tangle of questions. What if a loose wire gets wet? What if the mishap carries enough current to shock my heart and in a split second I'm history, killed by gadgetry? Will my native friends laugh at the irony? Will my loved ones angrily complain I should never have traveled to Japan in the first place? While Elvis Presley died of an overdose from mixing 10 kinds of pills into a lethal cocktail that would at last quench his thirst, I had no intoxicants since arriving at Narita International Airport, not even beer or wine, just buckets of hot green tea. I ran my trembling hands through my hair and shivered. Stop thinking about Elvis Presley. All that's beside the point. I gotta go. I closed my eyes. All I could see was a bare red body cupped beside an icy cold porcelain throne, an ode to modernity. A few more seconds passed. At last I opened my eyes. The toilet and I regarded one another. Kanbanwa. Then I bowed slowly as I'd been taught, sat down, and hoped not to die. I did not die. What I won't know until much later is there will be many times during my travels across Japan that I will wish I were dead. I was out of my depth, out of my mind, using the wrong words, consistently acting on the wrong assumptions, making too many cross-cultural mistakes. Oklahoma could not have prepared me for the Far East. So I'm going to skip over quite a bit, finish this first section. There's a lot more, and there's a lot more after I finish this section, but I'll end there. On February 19th, M. Kanihara and I traveled by train to visit the Shinto shrines and later a famous Buddha shrine in Kanagawa Prefecture. He'd taken a few days off from his university work to show me around Japan. We talked. His academic specialty was ethno-literature translation, and he said he was interested in native fiction writers. It was through his mother's connections with the BRCA Liberation League of Japan that he was able to invite me. He told me that the discriminatory practices against the BRCA people in Japan have a long and complicated history, much like the prejudices against American Indians in the United States. Discrimination against BRCA people has nothing to do with race, language, customs, or religion. BRCA mean are wholly Japanese, unlike the Ainu around Hokkaido, who are the indigenous people of Japan, or the Koreans of Japan, who were brought in as forced laborers from 1939 to 1945. BRCA history can be traced back to the feudalism of Tokugawa shogunate starting in the 16th century. Under shogunate rule, people were put into four classes according to their occupations. These classes were assumed to be a natural order of descending importance. Below the four classes were other groups of people known as outcasts or untouchables, with occupations thought to be polluting, demanding, or undesirable. The untouchables were butchers, leather craftsmen, entertainers, flower arrangers. In other words, they were artists. It's hard to understand, isn't it? I said, Braku people are the same as mainstream Japanese in all ways, but they're treated differently, like a racial minority in the United States. Yes, he answered, the Braku mean are members of a socially constructed minority. But isn't that the story in all societies? How does one know, I ask, if they're about to marry a Braku person? He said, the genealogy records of families go back centuries. Mothers and grandmothers can have the research done to make sure their daughters or granddaughters are not marrying into a Braku family. We then headed to the great Buddha of Kamakawa in Kanagawa Prefecture. It was a bright and sunny day at the site and felt so much warmer than Tokyo. Throughout the rest of the day, we talked about various nuances in the works of American Indian writers. I brought gifts for my Japanese hosts, books by N. Scott Momaday, Leslie Silko, Vine Deloria, Louisa Erdrich. He told me the names of some American writers that had been translated into Japanese as quote-unquote native. Jamiki Highwater is not an American Indian, I said bluntly. M. Kanihara appeared pensive. Highwater lied about his identity so much that eventually the Smithsonian investigated his claims, I said. I explained that Jamiki Highwater had a colorful but contradictory personal story. He said he was born in L.A., then Canada. He said he was of French-Canadian descent, then Blackfeet. He applied for all kinds of American Indian scholarships, and he received them. M. Kanihara was thoughtful and didn't respond. This is fraud, I said angrily. As we sat in front of the 13-meter-high bronze statue of the Buddha, I couldn't stop talking about ethnic frauds and said they were the modern equivalent of 19th-century Indian agents. In light of all the problems facing the world's indigenous peoples, I knew the fraudulent identity issue sounded trivial, but I wouldn't let it go. They invent beliefs and practices that never existed, I said. I yammered on and on like some kind of maniac. I don't excuse my irreverence at the temple site except to say I wasn't seeing the statue of Buddha, nor was I seeing the other tourists there. I was seeing Choctaw people in the lower Mississippi Valley in 1738. Smallpox blankets arrived in the east and were traded west along with the smell of oblivion, gifts from hairy fingered foreigners. I was seeing our warriors fall and get up, then walk through a door that centuries later I would emerge from, my fist clenched at birth, screaming, "Who wants to fight?" I was seeing myself, a warrior engaged in a desperate battle I will not win, enemies on all sides. Then suddenly I awaken in the sunlight, surrounded by the lush greenery and hackberry trees, frightened by the raging woman I'd become at the Buddha shrine. While our tribes are fighting the government, I said, in federal court, these ethnic frauds market themselves as medicine men, charging hundreds of dollars to unwitting people who want an exotic Indian ceremony. M. Kanihara was solemn now, withdrawn. I'd bullied him into silence. When he finally spoke, I measured the distance of the words between what he said and what he thought. I liked M. Kanihara, yet I'd shown myself a fool. I'd wounded him, a man gracious enough to bring me to Japan. I dug around my purse for a tissue to wipe my eyes and pulled out my journal, something to write on. Something to write on, something to mark my shame. Suddenly, a band of Japanese Baptist missionaries swept by us, fervently praising God as they passed around a collection plate at the great Buddha of Kamakawa. Just as we're about to lose our bearings, fate lends a hand, he said serenely. I looked up from my journal and tried to smile. M. Kanihara stood up. He faced, his face tranquil, eyes judicious, regretting me, I supposed. Yet he was deferential. He said that we should circle the large stationary object that may or may not have known it was being watched. After we circled the Buddha, I walked alone for a time outside the sanctuary, thinking about the images I just conjured up. Memories. Whose are they? Is this pain I carry mine or my family's? Does it come through blood ties, stories, or both? If so, we're all carriers. Facing the Buddha, I silently ask again, whose memories? Then listen to the weight of knowing. Loy E. Billy died in World War II, shot to pieces 2 weeks after his 19th birthday. My uncle, just a boy, really, only 5'3" tall, 124 pounds. At 16, Loy enlisted in September 1940, on the same day his older brother, Slish Billy, who was 3 months shy of his 20th birthday. Loy lied on his enlistment application saying he was 19, and both my uncles listed actor as their civil occupation. Apparently, no one in the enlistment office could read irony. Uncle Loy was a fighter. I have pictures of him in his boxing gloves, dukes up. He fought in amateur boxing matches in and around McAllister and wanted to become a Golden Gloves champion. Because he'd only finished grammar school, he became a private, eventually serving in the Army Company F, 180th Infantry Regiment, 45th Infantry Division. Uncle Slish was a second lieutenant in command of Fox Company and Loy's commanding officer. Over the course of Slish's service, he was wounded 4 times and received a Purple Heart, a Good Conduct Medal, an American Defense Service Ribbon, a European African Medal with a cluster of 5 bronze stars and 2 silver stars. He was also a Choctaw Code Talker in World War II. In 2008, Slish was awarded a Congressional Gold Medal posthumously, along with the other Choctaw Code Talkers of World War I and World War II. But Slish's greatest act of heroism might have been pulling his brother up off the ground the day Loy was killed. Together, they took a step forward into hope and then acceptance. A specimen of ruin. The pure light that took Uncle's place that day still remembers him, as does his family. Carrying the memory of it is hard. Without warning, it can cut through flesh and bone, revealing its truest nature, a crushed thing. Later that evening, after M. Kanihara dropped me off at my hotel, I searched in my purse for another tissue and found a small pamphlet titled The Great Buddha of Kamakara. I'd forgotten I had it. One of the lines jumped out at me. The central teaching is that through the devotion to Amida Buddha, expressed through mantras and sincerity of the heart, one will go to the Pure Land or Western Paradise after death. A pleasant realm from which it is easy to attain nirvana. Idakimasu, I said quietly as a prayer, both hands on my heart. I humbly receive. Thank you.